great pleasure to introduce Ben Webster from the University of Oregon and MIT, who will tell us about representation theory and a strange duality for studying varieties.
All right. I wanted to thank David for inviting me and say hello to the entire internet. All right. So this talk, since it's a two-hour talk, it's going to be a little long, but this is kind of the whole plan. So again, you can just go home and now read the slides on your computer. So what I want to start out with is something very combinatorial and explicit, and then kind of build up to how that sort of is a little piece of a much bigger story. And this one actually is on the web right now. If you wanted to go download it, you could. It's also like linked from my webpage, so you don't need to furiously write down the URL. All right. So this talk kind of starts off with a mystery. But everyone knows you can't find the dead body on the first page because you have to do the notation first. So let me just kind of put some words out. So what I'm going to sort of start off talking about in this talk is some combinatorics of hyperplane arrangements. But not quite just hyperplane arrangements. Hyperplane arrangements with some extra data. So one piece of extra data is it's not just a set of subspaces. Rather, I'm thinking of my hyperplane arrangement as taking a subspace, embedding it in Rn with those actual coordinates, and intersecting the coordinate arrangement with my subspace. Every hyperplane arrangement can be written in this way because the hyperplanes can be made the vanishing sets of linear functions. I mean, this is when it's going through the origin. We'll take it off the origin soon. All right, so my next piece of data is an element in the quotient, which is how you take the hyperplanes off the origin. You say, well, I didn't really want that subspace. I want an affine subspace that's a translate of it. And then when I intersect that with the coordinate arrangement, I'll get some interesting hyperplane arrangement where the hyperplanes have been kind of pushed off from each other. And I'm always going to assume that I've kind of done this in a generic way, so that there's kind of never too many hyperplanes going through one point. So you see here, there's no point that has more than two hyperplanes going through it. The kind of technical way of saying this is that this is a simple hyperplane arrangement. And the last thing I'm going to choose is another piece of extra data, which somehow seems to have disappeared from my picture. But I want to choose a direction, which I think of as an element of the dual of V. Now, since I've taken a coset of V, I don't get to think of an element of V dual as a function anymore. But it's still a direction. If I have two points, I can take their difference, evaluate it on V, and I can decide whether that difference was positive or negative. So I get to think of this as kind of, even though it's not a function, I can still ask, say, if it has a maximum on a particular set, right? Because it makes sense to compare the values at two points. Yeah, I guess that, I had drawn a little arrow on there before, but I guess it's not showing up. All right. So, like I said, we'll always kind of choose this in a generic way, which for the positioning of the hyperplanes means there's never too many going through a point. And for the positioning of this direction kind of means it's not orthogonal to any of the hyperplanes. That's kind of the bad thing that could happen is if it's orthogonal to a hyperplane. All right. So, as I think I said, the picture that you're seeing here is in the coset of V, and the hyperplanes are the vanishing sets of the coordinate functions. And one piece of, terminology that I'll use is that the connected components of what I get after I pull out these hyperplanes, I'll call chambers, and I'll call it chamber bounded if this element of V dual I chose has a maximum on it. So like I said, even though it's not a function, it's well defined to ask whether it has a maximum. So I can take any two points in my chamber and decide which one has a higher value of V. If it's generic. Yeah, I mean, you have to take the closure. I probably should have said, yeah, bounded if it achieves a maximum on the closure of the chamber. If that's what you're worried about, I don't know if it is. No. Okay, no, sorry. This should be called something like relatively bounded. Because it's bounded above, it's not bounded below. Yeah, exactly. So the shaded chambers are the bounded ones for one that points this way. Yeah, that's one of those things of notation where you get so used to using it, you completely forget that it would confuse other people. So I'm sorry about that. I think this is actually standard terminology from linear programming, though I honestly forget at the moment. So don't quote me on that, but I think that's right. All right. So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to take this combinatorial input, and I'm going to build an algebra. So the first thing about this algebra is it's kind of base ring, is that I take functions on this subspace V, so sim of V dual. That's kind of the algebra that I start with. And I'm going to have one generator for each pair of chambers, ordered pair of chambers, that are adjacent across a single hyperplane. I'm going to have an idempotent for each chamber. And then to incorporate this algebra, so I don't want to pick a basis of V, because I want to think of V or V dual as an abstract vector space. But I do know a set of vectors that span V star. V is a subspace of Rn, so its dual is a quotient of Rn. And I want to think about the coordinate functions R on Rn. So, I mean, somehow it's tempting to write this as I have these elements Ti, and here are these crazy relations between them. But the crazy relations between them are exactly the relations between coordinate functions on Rn when you pull them back to V. That's just kind of making my life more convenient notationally. So what are the relations? So here's kind of an obvious relation that says the idempotents and these elements CAB play together in the most obvious way possible. When you multiply the idempotent on the left, it should match the left chamber. When you multiply it on the right, it should match the right chamber. If I go around the intersection of two hyperplanes, there's sort of two different ways of doing that, and I declare them to be equal. So that's one of my more interesting relations. Now, I declare the idempotent for a chamber to be zero if that chamber is not bounded. Now, this might look really strange that I introduce these idempotents and now I'm saying that they're zero. But the point is, when I say this idempotent is zero, it also says if I take this product and this guy in the middle is unbounded, then this product is zero too. So if I didn't impose this relation, I would have to have kind of a bunch of cases of all my other relations depending on which of the chambers were bounded and which were unbounded. And this lets me say it in a kind of uniform way. And the last thing is if I step across a wall and then step right back across the same one, I pick up a factor of this coordinate function. So again, right, this is saying that sometimes multiplying it by a coordinate function is zero if it somehow corresponds to crossing a hyperplane where you get to somewhere unbounded. So this is kind of the most compact way of writing these relations. And I'll just mention, again, I always keep forgetting to write down the gradings, but this algebra is graded with this guy having degree 1, this guy having degree 0, this guy having degree 2. You can check for yourself that these relations are homogeneous. Sort of the only really interesting one is this one, that I have 2 degree 1 things, and their product is degree 2. All right. So, I mean, this might look completely insane to you, to have just written down random algebra, random relations. Why the hell would you do that? But it turns out to have some really amazing and nice properties that you can prove entirely by hand. I mean, somehow these are properties that show up a lot in representation theory, but often have, you know, geometric or whatever explanations. These you can really just prove by writing down projective resolutions of things and, you know, figuring out what bases of various modules are. So one of these properties is being quasi-hereditary. Another name for this is that the category of representations is highest weight. And the idea is it has a collection of special objects called standard modules that kind of behave like Verma modules. So Verma modules have the simple modules in with highest weights of a Lie algebra as quotients, but they're not projective, they're not simple, they're somewhere in the middle. And so that's kind of how standard modules operate. Those who went to my talk yesterday saw kind of an example of these, though not all of the algebras that I talked about yesterday were quasi-hereditary. All right, another property that a graded algebra might have is that it might be causal, which means that if I look at the degree 0 part as a module over the algebra and take X of that with itself, I get an algebra that has 2 gradings. One is the internal grading. It came from the fact that I started with a graded algebra. I took a homogeneous module so I can construct a graded projective resolution. And the other one comes from the fact that it's an X algebra. It has a homological grading. And usually, you would see no reason for these things to coincide. If you write down a random algebra, almost certainly it will not be causal. But sometimes it happens that that algebras are. And it turns out that this one is. It's quasi-hereditary. It's causal. And one kind of interesting thing that comes out of being causal is that the graded modules of a causal algebra are derived equivalent to the graded modules of the dual. And, I mean, the functor is basically take X with the degree 0 part. All right. So, as you might have guessed, when I introduced these conditions, all these algebras satisfy these conditions. They're quasi-hereditary, they're causal, and their center is something rather identifiable. So probably, I doubt many of you know what the reduced Stanley-Reisner ring is, but let me just say, it's the construction into which you input a polytope and receive the cohomology ring of the corresponding toric variety. That's a combinatorial machine which does that. So when I put in, instead of a polytope, I put in the matroid that corresponds to the sort of generating vectors of Rn, the unit vectors of Rn, as elements of V star. I get a matroid that's a simplicial complex. It makes sense to apply the same machine to it, and that's the ring I get as the center of this category, or the center of the ring, I should say, which is the same as being the center of the category of representations. All right. So, I mean, this probably doesn't blow your mind, but it should. You really should not expect this to happen if you write down some random relations for an algebra. So a few of these are kind of recognizable algebras from representation theory. So one of the kind of most obvious hyperplane arrangements is, if you state it in terms of these subspaces, it's the subspace where all the coordinates sum to 0. So what you're getting is the faces of an n-1 simplex. And what you get is a particular block of category O for SLN. And similarly, if you take the kind of dual thing, where you let your vector space be the span of the all ones vector, Then the hyperplane arrangement is n points on a line. I mean, because the all ones vector intersects all the hyperplanes in one point. But if you make it generic, it intersects them all in different points. And again, you get a block of now parabolic category O. And I'll just note, these guys are actually Kaschwil dual. This is a kind of well-known fact from representation theory due to Balanchine, Ginzburg, and Zirkel. All right, so this might lead us to suspect, I mean, we have these algebras, we know they're Kaschwil, we know that Kaschwil things have a natural dual, so sort of the best guess is, well, maybe there's some involution on these hyperplane arrangements that sends one of these algebras to its Kaschwil dual. And the operation is a pretty simple one. It's replace V by its annihilator, which you can think of as in the standard inner product on Rn. I guess that is how you should think about it. Is Rn has an obvious inner product. You look at its orthogonal in that inner product. And if you look back, this you would probably have to download the slides from the web to see. If you look at what spaces these Xi and Nu live in, they switch places. When you replace a subspace by its annihilator, it's dual, and the quotient of the ambient subspace by it switch places. And for sort of funny notational, well, maybe not notational, but for historical reasons, you take the negatives of both of them, but that's not super important. Right, so this is called Gale duality. And it's a picture that's a little hard to think about, but here's kind of my easiest interesting example of it, which is if I put three points on a line, the dual, I mean, as I mentioned, right, one example of this is the all ones vector and the subspace where everything sums to zero. So in the case where I look in R3, I have three points on a line and the faces of a two simplex. And I'll just remind you, this is in Rn. So one of the things about this kind of these conventions about hyperplanes is that the hyperplanes have names. They have actual numbers attached to them. And the thing I intended for you to see in this picture that I'm trying to use the colors for is for Gale dual things, there's a correspondence between the sort of points where the most number of hyperplanes intersect. So here are the three hyperplanes on their own inside R1. And here are the intersections of two hyperplanes inside R2. And you'll see, here's the top one with respect to nu. Here's the top one with respect to minus xi. I colored them both yellow so you would match them up. But this one is on the hyperplanes 1 and 2. This one is on the hyperplane 3. Similar to this middle guy, it's on the hyperplane 2. And here it's on 1 and 3. That guy at the bottom is on 1. Here it's on 2 and 3. This is not a coincidence. So the way to think about this correspondence is you take the complement of the set of hyperplanes going through one point in your primal arrangement, and you get the set of hyperplanes going through a point in your dual arrangement. And the ordering that these points get from the vector nu is preserved. Whether you put the minus signs here or not is whether you want to keep that order or reverse that order. And honestly, I might have slipped up while I was making these slides and done the wrong one. But let's not worry about that right now. So what happens when I change my data a little bit? So remember, changing the direction I picked on one side changes how I arrange the hyperplanes on the other. So if I make the vector here nu, but leave the hyperplanes in place, this means on the other side, I leave this vector in place, but I move the hyperplanes. So if I make it zero, that means I push all the hyperplanes together. And then when if I send it going the other way, I keep going, I pull this guy out the other side, and you'll see my correspondence has stayed in place. Now one's at the top and 2, 3 is at the top. So these are, I find it kind of fun to play with these, but I just kind of wanted to give you a flavor for what happens when you do these. All right, and as you might have guessed, indeed this works. When you take Yale dual, you get the Kaschewal dual algebra. And this is actually really easy to prove, because for Kaschewal things, their quadratic dual is their usual dual, is their Kaschewal dual as well. So I'm really just taking the degree 2 relations and taking their annihilator and getting the degree 2 relations for the other algebra. All right, so the other thing that might have seemed strange to you is that I have these extra parameters. You might be used to the idea that a hyperplane arrangement is a like reasonable and somewhat interesting object, but you've probably never adjusted to the idea that a hyperplane arrangement with a random choice of direction is a natural and interesting object. So it's at least sort of somewhat reasonable to think maybe if I change these parameters, how much am I really going to change the algebras? What could happen to them? The answer actually is that you get categories of representations that are derived equivalent, but not necessarily before you take derived. And you can check, you know, there are projectives in one and projectives in the other where the sizes of the endomorphism rings don't match up. You can see definitely they're not Morita equivalent, but they are derived Morita equivalent.
Even when the combinatorics change, like when you cross through
stuff. Yes, yes. And I mean, you'll see for this one. Okay, I think in these pictures while you will always get the same algebra for these easy ones, the proof that they're derived equivalent gives you interesting derived auto equivalences of the derived categories of these guys. I think you need 4 hyperplanes in R2 to get an example of one where they're not Morita equivalent. But yes, for any generic choice of these guys, you will get derived equivalent categories. This is not an obvious fact, but again, it's not actually hard. In some sense, you think about a little bit of geometry, and you say, I think I know what bimodule is the equivalence, and you write it down, and indeed, it's the equivalence. Yes. Yes, yes. No, it's a very explicit bimodule. You can describe it in terms of combinatorics. If I wanted to give a 2-hour-long talk about these algebras, I could tell you everything you ever wanted to know about it. Now, the other interesting thing is, while they are derived equivalents, they're not derived equivalent in a canonical way. There's sort of an obvious functor you can write down, but that functor does not square to 1. So instead, what you seem to get is the action of pi 1 of some hyperplane complement on these derived categories. Or you could say there's a groupoid acting on these categories where the automorphisms of one of the points seems to be pi 1 of the complement of the hyperplane arrangement. What I mean is choosing... You can think of the conditions that make these generic are codimension 1 conditions, complex. So you can think of sort of forcing yourself to choose generic complex values of these as looking at some hyperplane complement. What you get is pi 1 of that hyperplane complement that seems to be acting. So, you know.
So that was sort of my question. So when you do it, when you move them in such a way that you don't change the combinatorics, is that what you're saying? Then there is some canonical identification.
Yes. Yes. I mean, if you move it in a way that doesn't change the combinatorics, the algebras are literally equivalent, are isomorphic as algebras. Right? I mean, sort of, the relations came from kind of crude topological stuff. All right. So all this crazy stuff happened from a set of explicit, hands-on, slightly weird relations. So what's the bigger picture? What is going on in the background that could make this happen? And if you know sort of a certain branch of representation theory well, you will have been nodding along the whole time with this, because all of these results have analogs for category O. The center is the cohomology ring of some variety. You have these braid actions of functors on them. You know what the causal dual is. It's something very natural. You have these standard modules. They're usually some kind of version of Verma modules. So somehow this should be reminding you of all of these results if you happen to know them. And the answer is they both come from a particular kind of geometry, which, since it sort of comes in many different, there are kind of many different ways to think about this geometric construction, I'll just write A brains and then try to explain. So if you're an algebraist, that means you take a symplectic variety and you do a deformation quantization of functions on it. And representations of that, I mean, probably it's best to think of that as, you know, sheaves of representations of that over the space, but often you have localization theorems where you can think of global things. That's kind of one way of thinking about what I mean. Another one is that you could think about the Foucault category. And for me, this is purely motivational. I don't know how to do anything technical in the Foucault category, but this all kind of feels right. And I mean, there are a lot of places where you would love to be like, here's a Lagrangian. This is an object in my category. That's kind of why I always bring up this Foucault picture, is I don't like to say, here's a Lagrangian. Take the structure sheaf on it. Check that that you can actually quantize that to a module of X. It's much easier to just say, here is your object. It is a Lagrangian. So let me just note, when I talk about symplectic geometry, I mean algebraically symplectic, symplectic in the algebraic category. So if you're used to symplectic geometry over R, really this is two symplectic forms that are the real and imaginary part of a complex symplectic form, and you go from one to the other by multiplying by I. And I sort of could have done everything in hyperkähler land. All of the varieties I'm going to talk about, I think, are actually hyperkähler. But somehow, at least on the kind of crude level that I would do in a one-hour talk, that's not going to be super important. All right, so just to give you a sense, algebraic symplectic is, to be algebraic symplectic is very hard. In the same sense that it's much harder to be Calabi-Yau than it is to be orientable, it's much harder to be algebraic symplectic than it is to be symplectic in the real category. And the kind of situation, the geometric situation that we like, that will somehow bring out the right stuff for us, is to have a smooth symplectic variety that's a resolution of singularities on a cone in the sense of algebraic geometry, an affine variety such that there's a kind of multiplication by C on it that pulls it all into the origin. And throughout the talk, I'm going to use the word symplectic resolution to mean this particular situation. There's a more general notion of what it means to be a symplectic resolution, but this is the situation I will be talking about. All right, so what's maybe not everyone's, but quite a few people's favorite example is to look at the affine variety that's the cone of nilpotent elements in a complex Lie algebra. Which, I mean, if this makes you happier, you could just say the variety of nilpotent matrices of a particular size. This has a symplectic resolution of singularities, a very famous one called the Springer resolution, by the cotangent bundle of the flag variety, thought of as a pair consisting of a borel and a nilpotent element of Mylie algebra in that borel. That can be identified with T star G mod B. And as a cotangent bundle, it has a natural symplectic form. So this is kind of the original example of this situation. So what happens when you quantize this situation? Well, you get the universal enveloping algebra. I mean, depending on what you mean by quantization, you might really think you just get a quotient of the universal enveloping algebra by some central ideal, but if you interpret it differently, you can get the whole thing. So the original BGG category O fits into my picture by taking the nil cone, quantizing it to the universal enveloping algebra, and looking at a certain category of representations over that. And it's also true that there's a kind of general result about the Foucaille categories of cotangent bundles, that they can actually be identified with modules over a quantization. So also, you can think of category O as sitting inside the Foucaille category of T star G mod B. Does this room have a clock? Oh. I see. Great. When did I start? 3:30? All right. All right. So now I want to tell you what the geometric situation that corresponds to all this stuff about hyperplanes is. And because, in part because it's actually a very useful general construction, but also because they're really nice varieties, and I think they're underappreciated. So what you want to do is do a hyper-Kähler reduction, or a symplectic quotient in the algebraic category. So you start with a torus acting on Cn diagonally. You look at the cotangent bundle of Cn, and you look at the algebraic moment map for that. So that, again, I'm using the algebraic symplectic form on T star Cn, not like the usual real symplectic form you would take on Cn. And let me just make this piece of notation that doing quotient with the double slashes means GIT quotient. Unfortunately, if you don't know what GIT quotient is, I don't think I really have time to explain it, but it's a way of taking quotient in the algebraic category. If you try to take quotients by groups that aren't compact, you can really get some sticky, sticky situations. So GIT quotient is kind of one way of making things nice. All right, and I'm going to get a variety that's a symplectic reduction in the algebraic category. I'm going to take the zero level of my moment map, which is actually the same as the conormal bundle to all the T orbits. I mean, the sort of equivalence between these two things is an exercise in linear algebra, but somehow I feel a lot better about this variety when I think it's the conormal bundle to all the T orbits. Because when I quantize, I'm going to be thinking about stuff like D modules on Cn that are equivariant for this torus action. So a D module on Cn that's equivariant for this torus action, it's going to be smooth along the torus orbits, so its characteristic variety is going to live in here. That, to me, is kind of why this is a natural variety to look at. Another way to think about this is you're sort of trying to take a cotangent bundle to a toric variety, but take the cotangent bundle before you take the quotient. All right. And I'll just note, if I put 0 here, then GIT quotient means take invariant functions, take spec of that. GIT quotient is kind of an upgrade of that so that you could get projective varieties instead of affine ones. So at A equals 0, I get an affine variety, and the C star action on T star Cn that just multiplies everything by a scalar still survives, commutes with the torus action. So I still get a cone. And when I pick a generic A, I get a resolution of singularities of that cone. And like I said, if you prefer to work in the hyperkähler category, you can do this as a hyperkähler reduction. So you can take the unitary subtorus, and you can take the three different moment maps for the three different symplectic structures that come from the fact that T star Cn is hyperkähler, and take levels of all of those, one of them with A, two of them with zero, and mod out by the unitary torus. All right. So, again, how you should think of this is it's a kind of enhanced cotangent bundle to the toric variety Cn of where you get do just GIT quotient of Cn by T. Because it remembers some cotangent vectors over unstable points that get thrown out in the toric variety. All right. And the way I get back to this original data with a hyperplane arrangement is to look at my moment map. So the vector space V, that was sort of the information of my hyperplanes, is the kernel of the natural map from the dual of the unitary torus and the all diagonal matrices, or all unitary diagonal matrices, which I think of as Rn, and the map of that to the dual of the unitary part of T. So this is a map between real vector spaces, and its kernel is a subspace of Rn. And I want to think of my moment map, not my moment map parameter, my GIT parameter, which if I went through the Kempe-Ness theorem would be my moment map parameter, as the coset that I pick. But I haven't chosen a direction yet. The direction comes from some extra stuff. All right, so I might get a picture like this. If I were to do a quotient of C4 by a two-dimensional torus acting in a particular way. And the way to think about the geometry of the hypertoric variety, I mean, I know the stuff we just talked about like probably sounded like a bit of a mess, but there's a good way to think about its geometry, just to look at this picture and say, aha, I see a bunch of toric varieties. I see a P2, I see a blow-up of a P2 at a point, I see a bunch of ones that aren't proper. Okay, these should be showing up somehow. And in fact, every single one of these polytopes has its toric variety sitting inside the hypertoric variety as a Lagrangian, and the hypertoric variety is a union of their cotangent bundles. It's a symplectic plumbing. Where these toric varieties, well, they intersect in the subtoric varieties corresponding to the sub-polytopes where their polytopes intersect. So this P2 and this blow-up of a P2 meet with one of the line infinity of the P2 is the exceptional fiber of the blow-up. And this is, and if you play around with the picture a little bit, this is really easy to see. All of these subtoric varieties are just take Lagrangian coordinate subspaces inside T star Cn. So take a coordinate subspace of Cn, take its conormal bundle, look at the image of that, you get a toric variety. All right. So that this is kind of the picture you should have in mind, that you somehow take this kind of big singular union of toric varieties, and then somehow you fill in their cotangent bundles in such a way as to make a nice hyperkähler variety. And I guess I should mention, the whole hypertoric variety deformation retracts onto the union of the compact guys. So it's actually homotopy equivalent to this union of a P2 and a blow-up of a P2. All right. So what I want to do is take the category that I had before, this crazy algebra, and give it a geometric interpretation.
Is it actually the total space of some smoothing of that kind of broken torque variety in the middle?
Well, it has twice the dimension, so it looks more like the cotangent bundle of all of those.
It doesn't have a sort of map or something.
No. The broken torque variety in the middle is the fiber of the resolution of singularities over the kind of worst point of the cone. I don't know if that means anything.
Oh, yeah. Okay. This one maps down to the cone, and that's...
Yeah, so that's sort of the exceptional fiber.
Okay.
All right. And one of the few changes I actually got to make in the first part of this talk is now this is actually a theorem that this category really is a certain category of representations of a deformation quantization of the hypertoric variety. And it can be sort of described as a category O-like thing. It's a little different if you're used to the representation theory, but it definitely feels the same. And this algebra, it's nothing mysterious. It's you look back at two pages ago. You look at what we did. We did a symplectic reduction. You just replace the cotangent bundle with differential operators, and you do exactly the same thing. So where you took a quotient, you take invariant differential operators, and where you took a fiber of the moment map, you mod out by an ideal corresponding to the moment map. This is called non-commutative Hamiltonian reduction, but in this case, it's really easy. So one thing you could do, and which actually I'm sort of currently in the process of doing with my co-authors, is looking at this, saying, well, I should really think of this as like a universal enveloping algebra, and then try to redo all of Lie theory. In fact, a lot of things are much easier in this setting than in Lie theory because, I mean, toric varieties are much simpler than flag manifolds. It's sort of the same principle. But that's another talk. That's sort of not the direction I want to go right now. All right. So now, you know, I showed you something sort of small and mysterious, and then tried to expand that out into something geometric. And now I kind of want to do a more general picture, right? This was intended to be kind of a hint that something interesting is going on here. So let me try to talk about the general picture. So, I mean, as before, I'm always going to want the situation of a symplectic variety which resolves the singularities of an affine cone. I mean, it's an affine variety, but I don't think of it as having a preferred embedding into affine space. You know, most of the ones that are interesting to me come up as quotients, so they're kind of naturally the spec of some ring of invariance, and so I don't have any kind of preferred affine embedding for them, but they're perfectly fine affine varieties. I mean, you know, the nilpotent cone example is actually a little misleading because that does kind of have a preferred affine embedding, but like, these hypertoric varieties, I mean, I'm sure I could find an affine embedding of any given one, but there isn't like a God-given one. You just know it's spec of some ring. All right. So first, you might have asked me back when I said, you take this variety, you quantize it. I mean, most people are used to the idea quantization is an art, not a functor. So why did I say you quantize it as though that were really a functor? Well, it turns out that sort of in this category, because I'm looking at something symplectic, not something Poisson, it kind of is a functor. It's kind of a universal, nicest family of deformation quantizations whose parameter space is roughly the second cohomology of this variety. I mean, I'm eliding over some technical points here involving cohomology of the structure sheaf and that kind of thing. But this is roughly the right picture to have in your head, that deformation quantization of something symplectic actually is pretty canonical. Just as, because deformations of a Poisson structure kind of correspond to deformation quantizations of a Poisson structure. Symplectic things, the only interesting thing you can deform is the cohomology class. So even in the non-commutative world, about the only thing you can do is change the cohomology class. All right. And some interesting algebras come up when we do this. Some of them seem kind of familiar. Some of them are weird. So, the universal enveloping algebra. Beautiful, familiar algebra. Everybody loves it. If you start with a symmetric power of C2, that's a good singular symplectic variety. Gets the symplectic structure from C2. You get a rational Cherednik algebra for Sn. And if you, instead of taking the symmetric power, mod it out by the Wreath product of some... Yeah, I mean, the Hilbert scheme is the resolution. Right now, I'm writing the cone. There's also a resolution in the background. I mean, the resolution isn't 100% canonical. So one of the things I am going to kind of gloss over in this part of the talk and try to talk a little bit about in the second part of the hour is, you know, how do I think about the fact that I have a bunch of different resolutions? You know. Not in the hyperplane world. No. Now I'm looking at anything that's a symplectic cone. Okay. I mean, I actually can realize the Hilbert scheme as the Hilbert scheme is a symplectic quotient in this way. It's a quiver variety, but it is by a non-commutative group. All right. So there are also these slices between Ger-lambdas and the affine Grassmannian, and those have a conjectural quantization, which is a quotient of a primitive Yang, of a shifted Yangian. And then there are quiver varieties and there are hypertoric varieties. And there are algebras. We can write them down. We don't really know what they are. I can say, take the invariance of this ring of differential operators and quotient out by this ideal, but that's not a very satisfying description of what an algebra is. So these still are kind of mysterious. I mean, these also are kind of mysterious. There's a reason that there's a question mark there, which is that these haven't actually been defined yet. At which? The actual inspiration was, which I didn't put in this, was looking at sort of a convolution algebra for the cohomology of those toric varieties sitting inside them. I'm honestly kind of forgetting now where that... Oh, right. The other place that it came from was my collaborator, Tom Braden, kind of got interested in kind of pretending that the hypertoric variety was the cotangent bundle of something, and then saying, okay, if it were the cotangent bundle of something, what would perverse sheaves on that base space look like? And he, being a McPherson student, knows some kind of voodoo about understanding perverse sheaves microlocally in the cotangent bundle. And he bravely did this on the hypertoric variety, knowing it was not a cotangent bundle, and came up with this algebra. Yeah, I think that's the actual story behind their construction. All right. So what I just wrote before for you was some algebras. And there's actually a general prescription for getting a version of category O out of them. So this is a natural way of attaching categories to symplectic varieties with a choice of Hamiltonian C star action. I'll just mention... I mean, one reason that I'm interested in this is in my past lecture, I said that if you want to do categorification, you have to have a supply of categories. And this is my supply of categories, is that I have a machine that I can feed symplectic varieties into and get out categories. You know, if you're an algebraist, you'll take some subalgebra depending on the C-star action, things with negative weights for it, and you'll look at modules that are locally finite for that. If you want to think about the Fukaya category, you'll sort of say this C-star action tells me about some conditions on infinity, seeing which points get pulled into fixed points and which ones get pushed off to infinity, and this will somehow tell me what kind of brains are acceptable and what kinds are not. So one, almost certainly too optimistic conjecture is that all the properties I told you about this algebra A of V, the beginning of the talk, hold for all of these categories. They're causal, quasi-hereditary, and that there's some independence of C star action and of resolution up to derived equivalence. All right. Now, these conjectures will not necessarily be very easy to prove. Actually, quasi-hereditary we're reasonably close to, but causal is going to be much harder. But you might also say, well, wait, there was a slide at the beginning that you haven't addressed yet, because you also talked about causal duality. If you think these categories are causal, what are their causal duals? Where do they come from? And I mean, this is weird, because we did something very strange on hypertoric varieties. We remembered that they had some connection to some combinatorial data. We did some natural duality on that combinatorial data and constructed a new variety. We didn't do a canonical geometric construction of any kind. We just remembered that there was some combinatorics in the background. All right. So based on these and other lines of evidence, me and some of my collaborators think that there should be some kind of underlying duality between symplectic cones that this is a particular example of. So for a long time, this was called symplectic duality, but I've never been happy with this name. It's just way too vague. But it seems that it should really be called S-duality, which is good. I've sometimes called it strange duality. I've sometimes called it symplectic duality. So S-duality is just taking the intersection. I think it's great. And the conjecture is that one of the things that will happen under this correspondence is you will get causal dual categories. What's a little funny, so this is this point about resolutions, is it seems that taking resolution on one side corresponds to choosing a C star action on the other side. So with the hyperplanes, right, the kind of placement of the hyperplanes corresponded on the other side to the choice of direction. So the choice of direction is like a C star action, and the position of the hyperplanes is like choosing a resolution. So it's a slightly strange thing, but it seems to keep working out. In all the examples we know, there really does seem to be some correspondence. I think in physics, this is that when you do three-dimensional mirror symmetry, the mass and Fiat-Iliopoulos parameters switch. All right. Anyways, when categories are causal dual, you actually get an isomorphism between their Grothendieck groups. So you get not just a categorification when you play around with this picture. You're supposed to get two categorifications. And some things should be easy to see on one side. Some things should be easy to see on the other. And I'll just mention, as I said, somehow these have something to do with physics. Unfortunately, no one really seems to understand the details at the moment, but many of the examples we know are Higgs branches of mirror dual three-dimensional. I think I shouldn't say gauge there. I should have said field theories. But, you know, these are mostly buzzwords to me, so it's a little hard to keep them straight. But I mean, there are actual papers in physics that say, okay, look at this variety, look at this other one, and they're the same varieties that we have sort of come up with as pairs. Though I actually think with the abelian case, this hypertoric case, basically the paper about this explains the case of Pn, which is dual to the An Kleinian singularity, and then says, oh, well, you can figure out all the rest from this. The other ones are like this. All right. So, you're right. Let me finish the list, at least. All right, so we do have a list of varieties. This is a good ending. So one is, if you have a hypertoric variety, you should take its Gale dual, as I said. If you have a nil cone, you should take the nil cone for the Langlands dual algebra. If you have a symmetric power, that's actually the same as self-dual. If you take instantons for a group on the Kleinian singularity for some Dinkin diagram, you should switch the subgroup of SL2C and the Lie group using the Mackay correspondence. And a quiver variety. So a quiver variety is specified by two pieces of data, a dominant weight for a Lie algebra and a weight that's has a non-trivial weight space for that guy. And I think you should think of those as co-weights and take the affine Grassmannian slice in the affine Grassmannian for the Langlands dual group. Right, so the absolute easy example of this, which is I think the intersection of several of these, is that if you take T star Pn minus 1, that's going to be dual to an An Kleinian singularity. So the actual cones are the singularity and rank 1 matrices. When you take resolutions, you get there's only kind of one crepant resolution of the Kleinian singularity and T star Pn minus 1. All right. I think that's reasonable for taking a break. As you can see, I'm exactly halfway through my slides, so I timed it perfectly.